From the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C., this is Rendezvous with History, a podcast that captures the drama of presidential decision-making. Dr. Anthony Eames sits down with prominent scholars and leading citizens to bring to life what happens in the White House and how it shapes the world.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Welcome back, Rendezvous with History listeners. It's good to have you back. And today I'm very pleased to be joined by my colleague, Michael DeGroot, Assistant Professor of International Studies at University of Indiana, Assistant Professor of International Studies at Indiana University Bloomington, and the author of the fantastic new book, Disruption: The Global Economic Shocks of the 1970s and the End of the Cold War. Michael, great to have you on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
So we always start off with, why did you write this book? It's incredibly timely, it seems, right? We're at a point now where there have been a lot of global economic upheaval in the aftermath of COVID or during COVID. And you take us back to the 1970s, where maybe there wasn't a pandemic affecting the world economy, but certainly a huge range of transitioning factors that are making things difficult on the leading industrial powers. So why did you choose to write this book when you wrote it?
Well, this isn't ultimately the book that I intended to write. I was originally attracted to the 1970s. Because when I started working on this project, the 1970s were at the cutting edge of the declassification process in archives across the United States, Europe, and even the Russian Federation. I remember the first time I went to the National Archives in College Park, I told them I'm interested in international economic affairs. And the archivist said to me, good luck, because most of the materials had not yet been processed. But I was quite surprised with how much rich material there was available. And in contrast to what I expected, détente really didn't provide an illuminating framework for me to understand what was truly going on in the 1970s. And there seemed to be a disconnect between the Cold War in the 1960s, something happened in the 1970s, and then we have a very strange relationship between the two blocs, where at the beginning of the Cold War, we have a competition between two independent blocs promoting contradictory visions of what world order should look like. But then by the 1980s, the United States is unlocking global resources to fund its welfare and warfare states. And the Soviet bloc had become dependent on on Western credits, technology, and goods for its very survival. So I became interested in the 1970s role in creating this change. And from a contemporary lens, I was also thinking about this project in the aftermath of the 2008 Great Recession. And in contrast to some of the predictions at the time, global capitalism survived. And I became interested in the 1970s when I saw similar debates about whether or not the West would be able to endure. The West has been perpetually in crisis ever since it was established in the 1940s, and yet it has continued to endure. So I became interested in why it was that the West was able to survive the global economic shocks of the 1970s, whereas the Soviet bloc could not.
I do like that. The only constant is crisis, it seems, for the West, and especially in foreign policy. And as you point out, global capitalism has proven to be remarkably resilient, and rumors of its demise often seem premature. So let's get to the central argument of the book, right? Your central argument revolves around this concept, this new idea of a welfare empire, and how successfully the kind of United States and the Soviet Union were able to manage that welfare empire through structural changes in the world economy, oil shocks, other issues in the 1970s. So what are the seeds of this argument? You mentioned that détente isn't a good framework for you. How did this argument develop over time?
Well, I began to draw parallels between what was going on in the West and what was going on in the Soviet Union. And so this welfare empire framework tries to integrate concerns about national security, economics, and ideology. And so during the 1950s and 1960s, what I noticed is by and large, the United States and the Soviet Union were disseminating resources to their allies and accepting certain disadvantages and implicit subsidies to help their allies develop. Now, this system that was put in place was largely unintentional. And in the Western case, this comes from the legacies of the 1930s and the Second World War. And for the United States, the overarching lesson, as Mel Leffler reminds us, of the 1930s and 1940s was that the United States must never again allow an authoritarian power to seize control over the landmass of Eurasia. If that were to happen, as Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan tried during the Second World War, then this totalitarian power would be able to mobilize the resources of Eurasia and project them against the United States, forcing the United States to become a garrison state. So the prescription for how to avoid this nightmare scenario from happening was to bind Western Europe and Japan tightly to the United States. So the dissemination of resources from the United States to its allies, accepting certain disadvantages like discriminatory trade relationships, the inability of the United States to devalue the dollar to boost exports, the United States taking a preponderant role in providing for Western security, this was done in the interest of building different types but robust versions of democratic capitalism in those key industrial centers. And the Soviet story follows somewhat of a similar arc, with the important caveat that during the 1940s and early 1950s, the Soviet Union was, of course, plundering and exploiting Eastern Europe for allies, for resources. But by the mid to late 1950s, the Soviet Union recognized that this model was actually counterproductive, because in order for Eastern Europe to serve as a beacon for what Soviet socialism could be to the rest of the world, as well as serve as an important buffer zone to protect against a feared Western attack, they needed to build strong Soviet socialist economies that had at least some degree of popular support. So we also see the dissemination of resources after the mid-1950s, late 1950s, to Soviet allies in Eastern Europe. And by and large, this system worked quite well. We see economic growth skyrocket across the industrialized world, economic growth rates that really hadn't been seen before. And then by the 1970s, however, you begin to see the United States and the Soviet Union grappling with trade-offs between their economic interests and their geopolitical interests that they really hadn't needed to make before.
Okay, so what you seem to just describe is the Bretton Woods system, the kind of emergence of the Bretton Woods system in the U.S. case.
Right.
Now you get to the 1970s, and Nixon enters with those challenges that you start to talk about, the kind of the disadvantages are coming to the fore. Can you specify those disadvantages that Nixon's administration is contending with, and then kind of give us a sense of what it looks like from Moscow?
Right. So in the early 1970s, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, what Nixon recognizes is that the distribution of economic power that had existed once the U.S. welfare empire came into being no longer existed. So the United States running large trade surpluses through the 1950s and most of the 1960s, but really for the first time since the 1890s, the United States runs a trade deficit in 1971. And for the United States, it had been able to accept these disadvantages, such as, as I mentioned earlier, the inability to devalue the dollar, to increase exports, trade discrimination, and so on. These implicit subsidies, which had been tolerable during the 1950s and 1960s, no longer were tolerable now that the United States was running a trade deficit. So Nixon, with his decision to shut the gold window in August of 1971, imposed a 10% trade tariff on imports was a mechanism through which Nixon tried to recalibrate Bretton Woods as a means of trying to reassert American supremacy. And what this ultimately wound up with was the devaluation of the dollar from $35 per ounce of gold to $39 per ounce, for gold, and other currencies within the Bretton Woods system also revalued their currency as a way of increasing American export competitiveness.
So one of the things we often hear about when we look at the 1970s and the late 1960s, we hear about the upheaval around Vietnam, we hear about the 1968 election, we hear about those types of things. We don't often hear about kind of average Americans' reaction to the upheaval in the Bretton Woods system, all those kind of economic challenges that are starting to kind of rear their ugly head. Yeah, you hear about Great Society programs a little bit, but not these specific issues. The stagflation, the economic misery, that's generally a story we learn about in the later 1970s. So what's the kind of average American's reaction to this slow crumbling of the Bretton Woods system that's underpinned American power around the world?
Well, everyday Americans feel this problem quite acutely. And the way that we often describe the Bretton Woods system is a very technical, economic, and monetary system better left to the technocrats in Washington and other capitals. But the reality on the ground is that Americans feel this quite acutely. And they feel this most acutely in the form of rising unemployment and rising inflation. And in fact, by 1966, Americans are already ranking inflation, which is going to get much, much worse the following decade, is the third most pressing problem after the Vietnam War and race relations facing the United States. And they're also dealing with the beginnings of deindustrialization. The United States, of course, was the manufacturing superpower in the mid-20th century. This is one of the reasons it was able to accept some of the disadvantages, because American industry was simply much stronger than its foreign competitors. But by the late 1960s, early 1970s, that was no longer in place. And so for Nixon, when he tried to recalibrate the Bretton Woods system, he's not just thinking about international partners, but he's very much thinking about domestic concerns about inflation and unemployment.
So you lay out the book kind of bouncing back and forth between East and West, West and East, chapter by chapter. Really effective way of getting across the argument. And on the issue of the welfare empire, which is really your kind of central organizing device, the Soviet Union seems to be kind of the reactionary power, always one step behind the West in terms of formatting and reformatting and reforming its economic dependencies with client states. Do I have that right? Is the Soviet Union second in step on these economic issues, or is there another story here?
Well, it certainly didn't seem that way to contemporaries of the 1970s, because as the Western powers were dealing with stagflation, rising unemployment, monetary instability, the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, the oil shocks, and so on, at least outwardly, the Soviet bloc seemed pretty stable. Because things like recessions, things like monetary instability were problems that capitalist economies were supposed to be dealing with, not centrally planned. Of course, that's part of the purpose of having a command economy, is so that you have certainty and you don't have to deal with these unexpected shocks. But what we can see in retrospect, looking back after the fact, is that the United States and its partners were able to undergo a really painful adjustment to some of these shocks, whereas the Soviet bloc was not really able to make that adjustment. And I think there are really two keys here to help explain why the West was able to make these adjustments, whereas the Soviet bloc was not. The first is that capitalism turned to be a lot more malleable and a lot more adaptable than Soviet socialism. And as the United States and some of its Western partners underwent deindustrialization and the shift of the manufacturing hub of the world from the transatlantic community to parts of the developing world, the United States took a new position in the International Division of Labor, harnessing the computer revolution. The Silicon Valley was established a few miles away from where I grew up and not behind the Iron Curtain. In contrast, Soviet socialism was not able to make this adjustment because any type of adaptability was disruptive to the command economy, and there's not room for this type of creative destruction to take place behind the Iron Curtain. And in a democracy, where governments are responsible to all of their populations, it was more politically tenable to place the burden of adjustment on the working class. And the working class suffered a tremendous amount from these adjustments. In contrast, behind the Iron Curtain, these are proletarian dictatorships, which cannot put the burden of adjustment on the working class, because that's the very justification of the existence of the communist dictatorships. So I think that these two pieces kind of help explain why the West was able to adjust and create a new international political economy that worked for most of its members, whereas the Soviet bloc continued to stagnate and was not able to make the jump from what's known as extensive growth to more of an intensive process.
Let's zero in on a couple of those kind of painful readjustment crises or periods, specifically the oil crises. And you can start with 1973, and if you want to get to 79, that's fine. But you point out that on the outward appearance, the Soviet Union seems a lot better prepared to handle the oil crisis of 73. But you frame it as kind of a double gut punch, whereas the West maybe received a single kind of, you know, haymaker. The Soviet Union gets a double haymaker here in a way that that contemporaries were not expecting. Get into the weeds of that for me. What is that double punch?
Mm-hmm. So what I was not expecting to find in the archives was pessimism about the Soviet bloc in the context of the global oil shocks. Traditionally, this the impact of the oil shocks on the Soviet Union is explained as being a boon, a windfall for the Soviet Union. By 1974, the Soviet Union was the world's largest oil producer, so it makes sense that they would benefit financially from the opportunity to export their products at much higher prices. And that certainly is true. And you can see Soviet coffers being filled because of the oil shock. But the reality when you get into the archives is that the reality is a little bit more nuanced, because the Soviet Union was not just responsible for the smooth functioning of its own economy. It's also responsible, given its hegemonic position, for the smooth functioning of its entire bloc. And what I mean by the twin oil shocks in the book is that the Soviet bloc's actually hit twice by the oil shock. The first is that even though the Soviet Union provided most of Eastern Europe's oil supply, depending on the country, somewhere between 8 and 20% still needed to be purchased on the world market. So Eastern Europeans have to pay these same high oil prices that those in the Western world need to pay for that subset. And the Soviet Union also, recognizing that it cannot continue to shoulder the burden that it had previously, decides to increase the cost of its own oil within Comic-Con. And for the Eastern Europeans, this is absolutely a terrifying double whammy, because in the early 1970s, they had decided to pursue what's known as debt-led development. As their economic growth paradigm begins to run out of steam in the late 1960s and early 1970s, they decide, as a way of ensuring that our growth continues and ensuring that living standards don't drop, they were going to take credits from the Western world to purchase Western goods and technology. And now, with the Soviet Union insisting on higher prices, now they not only have to send more to the West in order to pay off this debt, which they can't because their products aren't particularly competitive, but not only are they dealing with what to do about this rising debt to the Western world, now they also have to send more goods to the Soviet Union in order to satisfy Soviet demands about higher prices. So when we step back, we can say again that the Soviet Union is a beneficiary insofar that it earns more currency. But in terms from a national security perspective, this is quite scary because this double whammy impacts the stability of the Eastern European proletarian dictatorships.
Michael, you pointed out that Eastern Bloc products don't always compete with those in the West during this period, and that's one of the reasons that debt-led development isn't really a smart strategy or a sustainable strategy. I just You know, these are some of the moments that bring a smile to a historian's face when you compare those technologies from different competing systems. Do you have any kind of maybe humorous examples of how East and West technologies didn't exactly or how the East didn't exactly compete in the high tech space as the West did?
To give one example, it was said that you could tell how important a Soviet official was based on how many telephones that he had on his desk. In the West, you had the technology where you could have multiple lines going through one apparatus, but that technology didn't exist in the Soviet bloc. So high-ranking Soviet officials had to have multiple telephones on their
and hence the legacy of bigger tables for Soviet dictators. Okay, well. Let's push forward into the 1970s. Eventually, we're going to end up at the end of the Cold War and talking about our namesake, Ronald Reagan. But first, you have a chapter titled The Travails of Jimmy Carter. It really dives into the mess he inherits and also the messiness of his own kind of thinking and solutions to those problems. Starting with the locomotive theory, this isn't probably a theory that's well known, certainly to the general public, but even within kind of your subset of historians who are really zeroed in on the Cold War. What's the locomotive theory that Carter starts to look into?
The locomotive theory is Carter's solution to the continued stagflation of the mid-1970s. So the worst of the oil shock, the recession that it had caused in the mid-1970s had passed. Inflation was coming down. Economic growth began to pick up. But Carter recognized that there were still significant problems, and nobody had yet figured out how to recapture the non-inflationary growth of the 1950s and most of the 1970s. And this is not just an economic problem, but this is a fundamental security problem. Because if the United States' overarching grand strategy was trying to tie Western Europe and Japan tightly to the United States, economic stagnation threatened to cause support for democracy and capitalism in some of these key industrial places to wane. So the locomotive theory was Carter's solution to try to reignite non-inflationary growth. And what it called for was for the United States, West Germany, and Japan together to serve as the locomotives, the stimulators of the global economy to try to get global economic activity up and running. Now, this is also an important innovation from the welfare empire structure of the first part of the Cold War, because in that period, the United States took fundamental responsibility for stimulating global economic activity. But now by the 1970s, as the distribution of economic power had diffused somewhat, Carter was calling on Japan and West Germany to take more responsibility. West Germany and Japan, however, were resistant to this because they didn't want to expand their economies and run the risk of inflation running higher and also limit their export opportunities because they would be called upon to import more goods. So while the Carter administration lobbied West German and Japanese officials, by and large, the American locomotive in the late 1970s was really the only one that was speeding forward.
So now let's get to our namesake here at the Institute, because you've just laid out the hopes that Carter had for reforming the economic system of the West. That locomotive seems to not churn and chug at the rate that Carter would hope, in part because Japan and West Germany don't seem to cooperate on this front. But you suggest that kind of the Reagan administration's policies really opened the United States up to foreign investment, which ultimately financed that the largest peacetime arms buildup in the history of the United States at that time, which is critical for Reagan's strategy of peace through strength. You also suggest those policies don't actually quite work the way that policymakers intended. So what are the mechanics here? What's going on here?
The Reagan administration inherited a really difficult economic condition. In 1980, the United States economy had been in a recession. Inflation was up. Unemployment was up. This is the context of the second oil shock, where prices go even into the above $40 per barrel. The Volcker shock is taking a hit. So So the Reagan administration inherits really a big mess. And for Reagan himself, his solution to this problem is to try to get the government out of the economy. And his overriding priority is to try to lower taxes. And he expects that lower taxes not only will stimulate economic activity, but will increase government revenues. And this strategy simply did not work. The Laffer curve on which it was based did not bear out in reality. In addition, there were increased stresses on the U.S. government budget, including an increase in military spending, as you mentioned, and also an unwillingness of Congress to cut social spending as a means of trying to close the emerging budget deficit. But the Reagan administration's only one actor in this story, because alongside the Reagan administration's policies, we also have the U.S. Federal Reserve under Chairman Paul Volcker pursuing a very high interest rate policy. And so you have, because of these two actors, a very strange cocktail of policies, which ultimately lead to the greatest peacetime economic expansion since the Second World War. You have large budget deficits, which encouraged the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates higher than they would have been otherwise. The high interest rate policy helps attract foreign capital. It causes the U.S. dollar to appreciate, which hurts American exporters. And so the influx of foreign capital helps finance both the welfare and the warfare states. So the social spending is able to be financed in part by foreign capital, and this military buildup, which reaches above $1 trillion over 5 years, also helped financed by foreign capital. And at the same time that the United States becomes dependent on this foreign capital for the resurgence of non-inflationary growth, because of the strength of the U.S. dollar, the trade deficit goes through the roof, heights that had never been seen before. So here we have the final inversion of the welfare empire. So in the first quarter of the Cold War, the United States is disseminating resources as a means of creating symbiotic relationships with its allies. But in the 1980s, this relationship has fundamentally transformed, and now the United States has become dependent on the flow of resources, financial and material. And this relationship actually serves as a boon for the West. The demand in the booming American economy stimulates American allies' economies in East Asia. It encourages exchange rate competitiveness for Western Europe. It comes at some pretty significant costs. The budget deficit is a major problem that's never really solved. Debt continues to go up. And the growing trade deficit hurts American workers. And so this new international political economy in the late 1980s, you have some analysts who are suggesting that this is not sustainable. And Paul Kennedy, in his famous book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, was predicting that the United States would be the one who would succumb to imperial overstretch, not the Soviet Union. So you have two competing narratives about what the West's future is in the late 1980s. One, that this new international political economy is unsustainable, whereas others point to the resurgence of non-inflationary growth and the robustness of American allies' economies. And ultimately, as we begin to see the 1989 revolutions break out in Eastern Europe, it becomes clear that the American problems are more about burden sharing and tactics, whereas in Eastern Europe, the problems are existential.
Let's go to Moscow. How are the men in the Kremlin kind of reacting to what's happening in the West, this influx of foreign investment? Meanwhile, you have the debt load of Eastern Europe, all the other really critically important economic conditions and challenges that the Soviets are facing. So what's happening in Moscow?
Well, the Volcker shock has a massive impact on international lending. And for the Eastern Europeans who had become dependent on credits to continue to maintain their debt-led development, the increase in interest rates precipitates a debt crisis in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And it's in fact because of the Volcker shock that the solidarity crisis breaks out precisely when it does, because Poland in Poland, because they had accumulated the largest debt of the Eastern European countries, and now were facing a prospect of not being able to service that debt. And their solution in the summer of 1980 was to try to reduce government subsidies and increase food prices. And just as there's a long history behind the Iron Curtain of when you reduce those subsidies and raise prices, that people are going to take to the streets. And wouldn't you know it, in the summer of 1980, that's precisely what happens in Poland. Except this crisis goes even further, because you have the consolidation of an independent trade union, Solidarity, which threatens the very existence of communism in Poland. And what's quite interesting about this case in Poland in 1980 and 1981, in contrast to some of the other crises behind the Iron Curtain, East Germany in 53, Hungary in 56, the Prague Spring in 68, the Soviets consciously, and they say precisely this in their Politburo meetings, that the Soviets do not have the resources to go into Poland to restore order. If you break it, you buy it. And they understand that they can't take on Polish debt. And they also recognize that they themselves need access to Western credits and markets and grain above all. And so they're quite concerned about what intervention in Poland would do to their international position. And so what we see in 1989 is not something fundamentally new, but the debt crisis that emerged in the early 1980s and Soviet reluctance to intervene happens on a much grander scale in the 1980s, because the debt crisis is never resolved. It gets worse, and the Soviet economic position gets worse as well.
Okay, Michael, you've laid out a pretty comprehensive argument here, pretty persuasive case. Now it's time where we get to our hints for history section, right? Our what can we tell other scholars, historians who are interested in working in kind of your field and in this kind of further exploration of the relationship between economy and security and politics and the Cold War and beyond. Now, what's the archive? What's the untapped archive, the untapped source or the little used source that you really think others should pay attention to?
One of the sources that I was not expecting to be able to use for this book was Ergani, the Central Committee archive in Moscow. And this archive had been closed for many years, but it reopened in 2019. And not only had Ergani declassified a ton of material, but they also allowed you to take pictures, provided the material was on microfiche. And for the historians, you know that this is really a crucial thing. And so I was quite fortunate in that I spent the summer of 2019 in Moscow going through this material. But because of the COVID, shock, as well as the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine, these materials I think are going to be rather difficult to access for some time. But when they are available, this is a very rich treasure trove. And the other archive that I really found quite useful was the Bulgarian Central State Archive. And I use the East German materials. Those have been combed through, I think, pretty well. But the Bulgarian materials, I don't think have been quite as well utilized in the literature. And they have declassified basically anything that I had wanted. And it provides a useful it's interesting not only from being able to provide Bulgaria's perspective, but it also provides a useful triangulation source for understanding Soviet foreign policy, and particularly as the restrictions de facto or otherwise continue on Russian archives, those Warsaw Pact materials are going to be increasingly important. And so I was treated very well by the Bulgarian archivists, and the materials there are fantastic.
Well, we promise this podcast is not sponsored by the Bulgarian Tourist Bureau, but certainly a good plug to go to Bulgaria. Michael, one last question for you here. For young historians, you know, who are thinking about their first book, or thinking about their dissertation, thinking about some way to make a contribution to the field they're interested in, to this field, what would you advise? What would you recommend kind of looking into further?
I think that the writing of post-1945 international history is going through a real renaissance. And we're trying to grapple with what is the guiding framework for understanding this. And I was one of the reasons I was attracted to this was I read Daniel Sargent's superb book, A Superpower Transformed, where he takes a globalization lens to look at the 1970s. And if we think about how scholars will look at the second half of the 20th century, I think that there are a number of different avenues, a number of different frameworks that we might use. And so what I tried to do in this book is not take one approach or the other, but look at how stories of globalization, global economic shocks, combined with the Cold War to create some explosive and important changes that we're still feeling in 2024. And so I think a useful methodology is to see how these various narratives come together and provide a new vantage point on post-1945 international history.
Well, thanks, Michael. This has been a really great conversation. And I just want to make one last plug for your book, Disruption, The Global Economic Shocks of the 1970s and the End of the Cold War, now available. Thanks so much, and we look forward to talking and having you again.
Thanks very much for having me.
Rendezvous with History is a podcast produced by the Ronald Reagan Institute's scholarly initiatives. You can learn more at ronaldreaganinstitute.org and follow along on social media at Reagan Institute.